those aren't the guys. Those are Squatches.
You're listening to Bigfoot, Ground Zero, the science behind the sighting. To contact the show, email bigfootgroundzero@gmail.com.
So tonight we're going to be speaking with Bart Catino. A lot of you know Bart from Finding Bigfoot. He's also got a video out there on YouTube that shows some activity around just outside the firelight of a group of Squatches. He caught it on therm. You can see rock throwing, movement in and out of the trees. He's going to talk with us about today, along with an experience that he had, his first experience, 21 yards away from a Sasquatch on therm. You are going to be riveted. Great interview. Again, it's Bigfoot Ground Zero. Let's do this. All right, as promised, I am here with Bart Catino. How you doing, Bart?
Doing great. Thanks for having me, Dave.
Yeah, no problem. I appreciate it, man. I know you got a lot of stuff going on, so hanging with us is cool. I wanted to introduce you. I talked a little bit in the monologue about, you know, who you are, but you've done some work. You've been a longtime Bigfoot researcher. You have a couple experiences that we're going to talk about tonight. But you've also been on some episodes of Finding Bigfoot. To me, you're kind of the guy. I consider you the mayor of Bigfoot, because like you kind of know everybody. But give me a little background about yourself, and then we'll kind of get into the sightings and go from there.
Yeah, no, I appreciate it. Guess I'll start. You know, born and raised here, beautiful Monterey, California. For those that aren't familiar, here in the Central Coast, the Bigfoot thing was always it's always been a passion. And I got into it at a very young age. My brother, cousin, they had passive interest. And I don't know, about 6 years old, I don't know what it was, but I was always so fascinated by it. Started reading all the books, the ones, John Green and all
those.
Oh,
yeah, yep.
And, it just kind of one of those things that kind of stuck with me and I was always curious about. I don't want to say like I really fully believed that they were real, but I believe the potential for them to be real was really great. And it was always kind of the consistencies in the reports before we really had we're talking decades before we even had an internet or we had, communication wasn't what it was obviously today. And seeing those consistencies in the reports and people from all walks of life, it was always very interesting to me. And as well as I do, we get these invisible chains we put on ourselves in life. And I don't know why I waited till I was about 29, 30, I'm about 47 right now. But I finally said, the BFRO was having one of their first public expeditions. I said, what the hell? Let's do it. I'm going to go. Turned out to be one of the best things I ever did. Just hit it off with the right people initially. I mean, first person I met actually was Bob Gimlin.
Really?
Friend to this day.
Walked right into the honeypot there. That's awesome.
Right. Exactly. And, Moneymaker is, one of my best friends. Bobo is like a brother. Cliff, all the guys. Cliff was on that first one, but met him within a year from then. And, had such a great experience. I was like, God, this is, I'm going to pursue this and do this. I love it. And what I never really, my objective was always, the things are real. Let's prove it one way or another. Right.
Yep.
But over the years, those first couple years in those mid 2000s, they were kind of quiet as far as activity happening for me or any of the guys. But we really built up our relationship all those years and went to, so many places. Usually California, Oregon, Washington is where I'd love to get into Canada, but I've kind of stayed in the three states with California being my home base. And it wasn't until about, it was 07, August 07, when I had my best visual, I would say. And that was Mount Rainier in Washington, the Northern Cascades. We'll get into that, the thermal. And then, you know, it was one of those things. I just stayed in the field. Like you said, a lot of relationships. You know, I think I really knew the right people. I was never, and to this day, I'm not a natural woodsman. I kind of had to learn backwards and picking the brain of all the people that were.
Yeah, but I would almost say, I'd argue with that and say that that's probably almost a good place to be, because a lot of folks come in with what I call head trash, meaning, well, I've been in the woods a lot. I know my thing. But you came in and you were like, I'm sure you've camped and everything, but you were kind of green to all that. So everything you probably absorbed helped you going forward, you know? So I would kind of look at it like flip the lens on that, you know?
It's great, but it's a great point. I mean, it really was. I will say I came in very objective, you know, that could go either way, you know, as far as, do these things really exist or not?
I know.
And, you know, I got in a situation where, you know, we had access to thermal very, I don't say early in the game, but when thermal first became a thing in Bigfoot, you know, in 2006, and Wally Hurston, a good friend that helped fund us through VFRO, we had access. I can't remember the name of the unit. Oh, the X200 XPs. They were Raytheon thermal imagers, and they were 160/100 resolution. And these things are like $10,000 at the time. They used them, you know, the Iraq War, everything. And, that's actually what I had my sighting with in Washington at that time. Of course, technology's gotten better. It's been upgraded. By the time I, you know, had the opportunity in the Sierras in the summer of 2012, you know, I got them. I mean, I filmed them. They're 105 yards away. Great investigation. But the footage, probably C-, you know, as far as quality because of the distance, thermal.
Yeah, but I've seen that video, and I've seen your reenactment. And if people pay attention to that, how can they find that on YouTube, by the way? What's that titled so they can go to it?
You know, if you just put name Barcatino, Sierra's Thermal, it's going to pop right up. And really, it's what you have on there is you have the 17-minute documentary from Skeptic Phil Poling, handpicked him, loved him, and he did an amazing job. And then we've got about 11 recreation videos, because that's really... You know, as we'll talk about this later in the show. I really wanted to set even though it was average footage, I wanted to set the standard for investigation moving forward. So someone else gets, say, better footage, they're going to feel compelled that they kind of have to meet that standard, especially if it's better footage than that.
Yeah,
you know?
Can we have a...
And we all win from that.
Yeah, absolutely. I got to tell you, that video irritates me a little bit, but it's not because of anything you've done. It's because anybody who ever asked me, why do you think Sasquatch is real? I will point them to that video and say, watch this. And they'll look at me and go, I need a body. I'm like, bro, you just asked me. I'm trying to show you like one of the best things ever. So anyway, I just, you know what I mean? Like, I wanted to throw that in there because it is so frustrating to me, man. Sometimes people are just like, you know, give me evidence. All right. This is it right here.
Yeah.
Take a look at this. Now I'm too lazy. Give me a body. Okay. So be it. What are you going to, I'm kind of done preaching to the choir. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's frustrating, but I mean, I think honestly, the more years that have gone by now, and I'm a realist,
yeah.
And I think based on the claim that there's, you know, hairy bipeds undiscovered roaming North America and remained relatively unscathed. I mean, I think, you know, obviously you would agree the burden of proof is on us.
Right, correct.
But I would contend, you know, there's a lot of people in the field that, as far as when it comes, we're talking about... discovery, they almost expect like a lower standard based on all the circumstantial evidence, but based on what the claim is, I would contend it should be the highest standard imaginable.
What does that mean? So walk us into that a little bit further. What do you mean by that?
I would just say from an evidential standpoint, you know, beyond eyewitnesses, beyond footprints, which they're, you know, there's some very interesting evidence in the footprints. But I would say from either, you know, remains, which is a whole nother question in itself that we can get into, body, or, you know, we live in a world now with DNA. you know, and there's touch, there's eDNA, environmental DNA, which,
yeah,
which
that's,
could be
yeah, that is crazy.
What we're doing.
But you have to filter, if for folks who don't know what that is, and correct me if I'm wrong, so like you can do something with eDNA where you can filter gallons and tons of gallons of water and pull out existing DNA from that. Am I right about that, or am I completely wrong? Because it's a
kind
whole
of,
new,
yeah,
whole
I'm
new technology.
Not an expert in it, but how some of the guys I've talked to, the scientists, it'd be like spinning in a swimming pool, and they're able to get that individual DNA in that swimming pool. But I think with environmental, what they'll do is, you know, placing static cameras, you know, in an area, they're able to not only they would, like, for instance, get soil samples from an area from that camera view,
yep,
and see not only everything that's walked through, but and then they're able to do testing from that. I mean, they're able to do testing from smashing up a bunch of mosquitoes.
Dude, it is so crazy, man. So literally from the environment, anything you can not process, but anything that you can observe physically to sort out. It's almost like, you know, dirt, water, you know. I think one time Dr. Meldrum was talking about nests, you know, how you can find DNA in that. And I mean, it's a really, you know, I'm going to move on from this topic because it's way above my head, but I would ask people to go. I would encourage people to go out and search out eDNA and then, you know, find out what that means and kind of how that applies to Sasquatch. But dude, I can go down this whole road.
Hopefully we could bridge the cost issue. That's pretty much, I think, the biggest issue. It's not like, you know, you're able to just get out there and, okay, you've got a couple scientist contacts and here's a couple garbage bags full of soil, go to work. You know what I mean? The testing is prohibitively expensive from my understanding. And, you know, that's something that cost might get bridged here down the road as the technology improves too, as well. So.
Well, it's like night vision, right? At first it was like Gen 1 night vision sucked, and now you can pretty much see the hairs on somebody's arm. But dude, let's get into the sightings, these experiences. So,
yeah,
you know, talk about the one in Washington. I think you wanted to transition to the one in the Sierras. Obviously you're not going to give exact locations, but kind of bring us through the scenarios, man, because you've got a couple of really interesting stories, and I'd love the audience to hear them.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. '07 was crazy because it was actually going to be a 14-day road trip for me, essentially. Went up with Bobo and a couple of the guys and went up with our California guys. We went up and met all our BFRO Washington gang at that time. And they were doing Gimlin was there. They were doing a kind of a half social. There was a lot of reports over Bumping Lake, east of Rainier. And so it was all half social, half kind of, you know, expedition, if you will. And I think they were celebrating at that time, can't do the math, but 07, it was probably like the 40-something year of Patterson film, right?
Yep.
And relatively quiet trip, but third night, I was in Seattle all day during the day on the third day there, came back that night, and Gimlin actually had to leave, and a couple of the guys from my camp went over and took care of his camp while he went back to Yakima. And then I had this huge tent that was in our camp. Bobo was with us, a couple of the guys. And that night, I would say it was probably about midnight, right around then. At that time, Cliff was the only one that had thermals on him that was in our kind of in our crew. He had a stationary one, and he had a the handheld, the one that I use. It's interesting because nowadays we push a button, just like the camera. It's either internal onboarding recording or SD card, right? But back then, you really had to hold a backpack in front of you with a marine battery. You had the proprietary cords, plugins. I mean, it was a nightmare.
So you look more like Ghostbusters.
Exactly. And that's not even an exaggeration, really. But that night, I remember, I asked Cliff, I said, you know, I went back from the party. There was probably 13, 14 of us congregated, not all staying there, just kind of congregated. No fire, you know, just a couple lanterns. We'd already had dinner and everyone's hanging out, playing guitars, whatever. And we were just in a small section, and I had actually walked back to relieve myself probably 100 yards back. It was pitch black. There's a swampy area back there. And I heard something, felt a presence and heard something step, branch, break pretty close to me. And long story short, I kind of moseyed on back, asked Cliff, you know, you got the handheld on you. I want to just go take a look. And it's crazy because I've been back to this place and have led expeditions there for a lot of them in the last, 14 years. But the first time, the first 20 seconds I ever put an imager up to my eye in this place, you know, I saw a Bigfoot, but haven't seen anything there since. But it was crazy. Yeah, I actually had looked back down. If you can imagine a trail pathway that I just come from, looking, everyone was kind of to my left down a berm, all kind of congregating in a tight area. And I'm looking down and I see the biggest tree in view right where the trail bends. I go, oh my God, you know what? I think that's one of the, we had a couple of girls in the party and I thought one of them was trying to relieve themselves because you only saw 10% of the subject, right?
Right.
The head, the knees, that's it. But within seconds, this thing is right and left with its head behind that tree looking at me, steps out, which would be to my left. And at this point, I know now going back doing recreations, all that, where I was about 51 yards away initially. And I see this thing step out. I could see the whole right side of it. I knew, you knew immediately because, you can't really gauge the size, but the, just its appearance. I mean, it was very clear. Drop to, I want to say all fours, but not on its feet. All fours kind of with, it looked to me like knees down, arms extended, and a lot of fast transitioning on the ground. But it really started was the realization, you know, you're in shock initially. It's like, am I really, you know, seeing what I think I'm seeing? And I was trying to get Cliff's attention. So I was kind of whispering, snap my fingers, trying to get his attention. And he's putting stuff away in the truck, didn't hear me. But as I did that, this thing on the ground, this is a biped, you know, it's on the ground. And you know how like a small dog, you know, any kind of animal is inherently scared, you know, your foot stomps down, whatever. It was
right.
That kind of a unnerved movement to my sound, snapping my fingers, trying to get Cliff's attention. And this thing would just frantically, as if the sound of my voice was hurting it, then it would pause, freeze in between. It was the weirdest thing to see. And it looked just so, you know, impersonal seeing it through the therm. And there was a lot of fast transitioning on the ground. I think one time you and I had talked about this. It kind of got on its knees with the stomach perpendicular to the ground and actually did like a digging type motion, like or swimming type, I described it, like pushing the arms kind of violently back. And I didn't know if it was confused. I didn't know what it was doing, you know. And at one point actually got on shoulder, lifted, I think it was his left hand. And you saw all five digits on this splayed hand. It was just unbelievable while it was on the ground. Thing got back up, got behind the same tree, you know, some other transitioning, got down again, got back up again. The last probably 2 minutes I watched it standing. What a smart, stealthy son of a bitch. Not move a muscle. You know, it's an animal. I'm holding a thermal imager. I'm not giving off infrared radiation. I'm picking up the IR, right?
Right.
So technically, it's not night vision. There's nothing that should be a deterrent. Shouldn't even know I'm holding that thermal, technically. And this thing is just standing with its back to me. I'll never forget. Calves north. The whole enchilada. I can see it all.
Wow.
It's massive shoulder, big upper extremities. I'd say 2/3 of the weight upstairs. Legs long like ours, but not as thick. It was almost looked like, how's that hourglass body, but how's the bottom kind of holding up the top?
Right.
And then you had the agileness factor, like how agile this thing was and moving, I mean, just effortlessly.
Well, let me ask you this question, if you don't mind. I'm interested in the motion part, and it sounds like it was reacting to every sound you made. But the way I envision this is it's almost like snap, move. Hey, Cliff, move. Like it, every time you're saying something, it's doing some sort of gyration. Do I have that correct, or am I misunderstanding what you're saying?
You have it nailed, actually. That's exactly what
So how did it move? Exactly. Was it moving quick? So I guess it's moving with purpose, but it was jerky stop movements, or did it flow? Like,
correct.
What did it look like?
No, more like jerky stop movements. Like the immediate sound of my voice was almost like a hyper aware and like a shaking, like, and then a pause freeze, like in between, you know, after about second of my voice. So I'd be Cliff, snapping my fingers, and this thing would, would gyrate, move it. Remember, it's partially a tap on the ground.
Right.
And then it would just pause, freeze in between. It was the weirdest thing because you're almost looking at, it wasn't like a mimic, but you're looking at something that, I mean, it was just surreal to see it.
What,
you know?
Now, what were you doing when it stood up? So it eventually stood up. It felt like it could do that. Did you back off the sounds? Did you move back at all? Or what were you doing to give it that sense that it could do that?
I you mean from where it's, you know, once it did stand
yeah,
up?
Yeah, once it did stand up. Do you remember kind of what your mannerisms were? I'm just trying to kind of draw a parallel there.
I remember just kind of slowly, you know, right, left, like slowly creeping up closer and closer. Matter of fact, got close enough that I passed up where everybody was to my left.
So you went toward
it. And I went toward it slow and got to within, I estimated, going back doing the recreation, about 32 yards. That's how close I got.
So you closed the gap at 21 yards then.
Yeah, 21 yards, just kind of creeping here. A couple steps here, a couple steps there, trying to get a better look. And this thing, I think this thing knew, was confused why I knew it was there, why I was separate from my party, why I didn't need the benefit of a light source. Why I knew that's all speculation, but I'm saying that's, if you were to ask me, what did it look like? It was probably thinking, and based on the way it was reacting, that would be my guess, right?
Yeah, I'm wondering too. It's kind of scary, but I'm wondering, as you're getting closer, the thing stands up and you're almost thinking, okay, well, now he's saying in his mind, I see you. I hope you know I see you. You know, the standing up part is the one that gets me, because that's almost to me like, I wouldn't want to say an aggressive posture, but almost a posture of you've got him at fight or flight at that moment. Like, would you agree with that? Like,
I would agree with that. And it was interesting because, of course, it had its back to me. So it's a perfect position to just take a few steps and be completely out of the picture if it needed to. But instead, think about this for a minute. I'm not shining a light on it. It probably doesn't think I can see it based on any interactions it's ever had with watching humans. And I think that it just waited me out. Why give away your position? If he moves, chances are I can hear it. I can have, you know, maybe, I don't know how, the weapon or whatever, but to just freeze, pause. Like, let's just say if this was the afternoon, right?
Right.
This was the afternoon and the lighting was appropriate and your eyes were just scanning the forest, say, you know, you didn't have the earlier interactions, you would probably bypass it and just think it's a big tree stump. You wouldn't even.
Yeah. So what would you have,
you know,
and I'm going to kind of fast forward to this, but then we're going to back up and talk about other aspects of the sighting. But knowing what you know now, you relive this a million times. By the way, dude, 20 seconds into a therm for your first time. Are you kidding me?
Dude, not really? First time using a therm, but first time there.
Right. You know, okay. Gotcha.
Like, whoa.
I misunderstood that. But still, I mean, that's absolutely crazy. What do you think, you know, what would you have done differently? Because in my mind, whenever I go back through a scenario, I wish I would have done X, Y, Z. If you're looking at that same situation, what would you have done differently maybe than you did?
Actually, it's a good question. The only thing that I would have done differently is something I couldn't really control was, you know, we were stuck with what we had from a technological standpoint at that time. But the only thing, I mean, there really wasn't anything I can do differently or would do differently if you gave me the same thermal imager in my hand. And, you know, it has the same capability, and that's what I was stuck with. There's not much more that I would do except maybe even just try to keep getting it closer. Had I been recording, I would have done like I did in the Sierra, get as close as you can, but get as much footage as possible, deal with all the questions later. That's what you did. I'm glad I did that later in Sierras. But what I did do is actually got close attention. I'm just yelling obscenities at him to just get it set up. He just did it immediately. Like, I mean, and he was, and Cliff was fast. I mean, he's used to the equipment. So he was setting up as fast as he could. And at that time, everybody in our party, they're walking up, lights on. Hey, what's all the commotion? What's going on?
Oh,
light,
God, yeah.
It's not their fault. They had
I get it.
Figure out what's going on. And they're looking down, you know, the pathway, and I'm sitting there just like, I remember just the adrenaline, and I'm just like praying he gets it, you know? And he came back like maybe 5 minutes later, 10 minutes later, shaking his head. And I was like, damn it.
Now, do you let me ask you this question. And I apologize for cutting you off, but as these questions come up, I have to ask them. It seems to me, as you're talking about this experience, it's almost like you're looking through it on a television so you can observe it. It doesn't seem like your fear factor was high, bro, because a lot of people will say, like, man, my skin was standing up, but you seem really detached and observant. And is it because you were looking through the optics?
I think it was a combination of a couple things. I think it was unexpected. The last thing I expected with, you know, when there's so many other times where you would think, you know, you'd have the possibility. I just was not expecting it. You just hit a great point. Very impersonal. I mean, I would say myself, a couple of the guys, Cliff, I mean, we probably got more experience than, you know, 99.9% of people with thermal imagers, having seen them, you know, used them so much. I'm thousands of hours over the years and being able to discriminate, you know, what you see. And, you made a great point, because the optics was a big part of it, because there's something very impersonal about seeing it through, you know, a thermal imager versus, I'm sure if I saw, say it was a, you know, highly moonlit night and the dark silhouette was there and I could see it, that would have been a lot more, I think, imposing. It's almost like you're watching a black and white movie, kind of. There's a different layer versus how I would imagine seeing one in, you know, in person, not having the unit, maybe seeing one during the day, crossing the road in front of your vehicle, how I would envision or imagine that, which I'd get my right arm to, you know, see one in color. But both times. So there's like an element that even though I've seen them twice, I know these things are real, and got them the second time, there's an element that other people have experienced seeing one, say, during the day, or like I say, in road crossing or whatever, that I've never experienced. I would love to have that experience, have that close up and be able to see it in color. It's a different ball game with thermal. And I think too, knowing, you know, a lot of the party was there and it was just so unexpected, you know, really didn't. There was no sign.
Well, what is
it?
Okay. So then my next question is, you know, you're out doing research now. What is your mindset going through this? Because it seems like that the experience was fairly benign, not in the fear factor part, but the sense that the Squatch was just, you know, he was observing you in the party. He clearly recognized that you recognized him. What do you do now when you go out in the woods? What do you keep in mind? Are you afraid? Are you not afraid? Like, what goes through Bart's mind and how does he process that and do and research?
It's a great question. I'll be honest, first couple times I went out, for actually the first time when I was scared of my own shadow, it was really Bobo that helped break that very quickly. And then it was by the second, third time we went out, it was just like, if I'm going to do this, I'm going to do this right. I don't half-ass it.
Right.
And I want to do it. I wanted to be, you know, have to execute these at night, you know, with thermal. That was kind of my thing. And once this happened, the thermal aspect, we were already using them. But once seeing one with the thermal, that was like the niche, you know, that's where I was going to kind of just niche myself and focus. That's how I'm going to try to document them. I'm not an expert in other areas. And I've got so many people I have access to that are experts that worked. We worked together on everything. So, but what it really showed me is, and helped later, like in Sierras, was the vantage point, was watching. I mean, it was like military, like a vantage point over the human activity. We never would have known it was there. It did nothing to initiate investigation other than, you know, when I went back to relieve myself, if that was even it, I think it was. But other than that, there was nothing.
So we're starting to talk about the Sierras event that you had, and there were a multitude of people there as well. And we're going to see a theme as to what's happening with the party of people that are there, where the Squatch are in relation to the fire. You know, we're going to see some similarities there, but you did something different this time. But walk us through, you know, when was it, what, you know, month, time, year, date, just kind of walk us through the environment and then the experience itself.
Yeah. Remarkably, the incidences took place 5 years and 1 week apart. So both August. Matter of fact, my wife's birthday is in August and she tries to make, you know, she's great about not caring about Valentine's Day, but she thinks the whole month of August is her birthday. So it's always an issue because that's always my big, you know, my big squatching month too. So. But yeah, back in 2012, we're up at the Sierras. I know a lot of people have heard of the Justin Smea and the claim shootings, Sierra shootings, and that was really the whole reason I was up in that area. Derek Randles had kind of brought me involved in that because he's up in Washington, and I'm, you know, obviously a little bit closer. And we had gone to this site once before, Bo, myself, Meldrum, Majinsky. There's a handful of us there. Derek came down with Justin, Wally. And that's really when I had met Justin. And we kind of hit it off, became friends. And, you know, that's a whole nother direction, that story. But this was the impetus to really what happened. And this was August 2012. And so I'd written the polygraph for Justin Spana. And he ended up passing this thing 100%. We got the call. I was back home in Monterey. Actually, Bobo was down with me. And we got the call. He passed 100%. And he was actually taking a couple people to the site. Sean, who ran the Bigfoot Evidence site, I believe still does. He's a good friend.
Yep.
Rosa Hebe, Todd Hale is great. He's in the Olympic Project. Michael Lorenz was with us too. So what happened is he had taken Roe, Sean, a couple other people up there that night. They didn't even know they were going to stay the night. They ended up just banging on some trees for fun, whatever. It was basically just to show them the place because, right. If I remember correctly, Roe was doing the documentary at that time. Anyways, 3 a.m, 4 a.m, they have activity, wakes everybody up. They described it. It was like stomping on the tree line. It sounded like Jurassic Park. They can hear just a lot of stomping around the tree line, especially the southwest side of that camp, that circumference of camp. And I got the call the next day that, you know, and this site was never on my radar. It was never planned on research. It's a beautiful area of California, but some Sears are so big. It just was never a place I was going to go back to, really. And so long story short, we pulled everybody together. It was kind of last second, actually. And some of us met for the first time, but we went 2 weeks later. I went up and it was just a quick, I mean, I was literally there 40 hours. First night was just Justin and myself and had nothing happen. The guys came, you know, one after the other the next day, and Roe and Todd drove all the way up from LA together. Sean met us from Sacramento and we had nothing going on. It was maybe, it was probably about midnight, 12:30, something like that. And I was so tired from the night before that I just was looking at, God, you know, I was going to take Sean for a walk. You know, it's the second night in the woods. And I was going to take him on a 5-mile hike at night. And I was just exhausted. And I was trying to, should I just go to bed? And I looked at him and I said, you know what? Let's go break your fear of the dark. Let's go for a walk. So we did. And I told him, hey, do some calls off the Eastern Ridge right here, this Eastern Vista. That's above Sierraville. And he does. And the funny part is that we didn't know it at the time, but the Bigfoots were already, or had to be, right there in the vicinity when we were doing those calls. It was like kind of got our hand caught in the cookie jar a little bit, you know?
Yeah.
Because it was like minutes later. So we just kept, you know, we walked up, and as we kind of went around this bend to walk up, we're going to go straight, get to the main road and walk like 3 miles. And I told him, oh, stop, 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 stop. I've got a vantage point over camp. And I looked down and I'm seeing immediately what looks like a couple bipeds that are walking. And I'm like, wait a minute, I'm trying to position, you know, I've only been there once. I'm not that familiar with the area. It's late at night now. And I'm looking down and immediately I'm thinking, okay, that's, you know, that's the guys. And I was running audio on my head until they just started looking not like the guys from my position. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And the way they were moving, and then they would disappear for a few minutes. So I'm poor Sean. I'm describing to him what's going on. He's in disbelief. So he was literally holding on to my waist and I'm talking to him. I'm like, okay, but this is it. I go, breathe with me. You're going to don't move without me. Just everything nice and easy. All right. We're just going to stand right here and I'm going to keep filming these things. And I go, just like telling him, I go, if those aren't the guys, those are Squatches. I mean, there's nothing else it can be. So long story short, film for about a half hour or so, 40 minutes. Well, batteries are starting to get sucked dry a little bit. It was a cold night. Even though it was August, I remember that night got cold. It was 58% waxing moon. We walked back because I saw these things going back and forth in the tree line. We actually walked back at one point, had to get more batteries. Sean came back with me. We get back to the spot. And when we're in camp is when I was telling the guys, well, Justin and Michael Lorenz were asleep the whole time. Matter of fact, Justin woke up at one point and even offered his rifle for like, he was up for like 30 seconds, half asleep. And Roe and Todd, they had just been sitting down there by the fire. Fire was dying out, but they were just stunned. Todd was I knew I saw something up there. The silhouette, you know, they saw silhouettes fill the tree gaps. Roe, the same thing. So they're freaking out. They had no idea that I was on the top looking down, filming the Bigfoots. Mm. We went back up there and got them again. And what was crazy was it was the only window I had. Not the only window that was available, but it was the only window through the trees, the only gap where I could see them clearly going back and forth. I couldn't catch them. I've got like a bunch of footage of trying, you know, right, left, trying
right, yeah,
everything.
Yeah.
And it was weird because I knew at that time too, I'm thinking, you know, in my head, I'm like, I was completely psychologically prepared for it from what had happened 5 years earlier. I had to realize at the time, the personnel I had, Todd Hale's huge with Olympic Project now. He's great.
Yeah.
That was
oh,
one
yeah.
of his first times out. And then, you know, Sean's second night in the woods. I mean, there are, besides Michael Lorenz and Justin Hunter, I mean, you know, I didn't have like a really strong, strong crew in that area. And I was limited with equipment. I had no one down there I can communicate with. We weren't expecting this at all. So literally going on a walk before we hit the sack. And that's what I did is I stood there and I got as much footage as I can. And I'm glad I did, because what was weird, think about this. They disappear like 3-5 minutes at a time. You don't know if they're coming back. Like that could have been it, you know? And then boom, they'd come back in and they're like, oh yeah. And there was one that actually you can see on the recording where you watch slow on the big screen, you could see it. I mean, they just look like people walking back and forth until you see a comparison with the guys eventually. But one kicks that knee up, that left
yeah.
knee up,
yep.
drops
yep.
it, and just accelerates through that gap. And you're just like, nobody's business. And they just move different. You know, there's like a hyper awareness. There's a lot of parallels that I saw in Washington that really gave it away for me. It's like, you know it when you see it type of thing, you know?
You know, it's funny that as you're talking, I'm thinking of the appearance of a great ape with the fast mannerisms of like a howler monkey, you know, always looking around, always.
Yeah.
It's crazy, man. But that's kind of what goes on in my mind. Sorry to get you sidetracked there.
No.
Yeah. So take us.
It's a great point.
So take me to the part now. And if I'm fast forwarding too much and you want to back up, let me know. But take me to where you saw a rock throw. And I think that point is when, I think that's when Todd, because he said this to me, he thought he heard something throw something up the hill, and that's what got his attention. But I could be wrong, but back me up and talk me through that.
Yeah, that happened when we got back up. So we had gone back down to the camp. It's cool because I've got all the recording. You hear all of our conversation. From the minute I recorded them all the way through to meeting with the guys, and Sean and I go back up. All of a sudden, Sean's a lot braver now. He's settling in, right? Let's go. Let's do this. And going back up, I thought that I couldn't see them the whole, because you're kind of walking around a bend to get down into camp. And you've got windows through the trees all over the place, but I couldn't spot them. You know, I didn't know. Mm-hmm. I never would have thought they would be that close. So we walk back up. We're filming. And I remember telling Sean, and I just said something like, one of them just did something. Because I was, you know, even being used to seeing these, looking through a thermal, I couldn't tell what it looked like. A flash of light had gone by, right?
Right.
And we didn't know what that was until going back, you know, weeks later doing the recreations. But what it turned out to be was what we think when we did in the recreations was rock throwing. And we recorded what looks like a rock drop from about 10 feet up. And then about a second and a half later, just a laser beam projectile
yep.
that ricochets and bounces right off the tree. You know, I had a lot of people, they would argue with me, hey, Bart, that's a night bird. I said, well, look at the ricochet. Look.
Right, exactly. Was it a blind night bird?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And we tried to mimic that in the investigation using Kip. And it's very interesting because, you know, it didn't matter lights on, lights off in the investigation from what you're recording. You're just trying to match it with humans. And Kip, it's like, you know, he's a strong guy, but it's an arc to throw with humans. And what's very interesting about the whole thing is this was kind of the variable. Like if someone were to, this is what was quote unquote different. I have never, and I live here in Pebble Beach, I have never seen that many deer in a 2 mile radius as we did that night. There was multiple Nevada muley herds merged together And we actually had remarkably three of them, apparently, according to Todd and Roe, had literally come in and sat down in camp while near the beginning of when this was all going on.
Almost like they were afraid, less afraid of you guys than they were afraid of something out there.
Absolutely. Exactly. It was just really odd behavior, like almost sure sign a predator was around. It makes you wonder. I mean, we could speculate till the cows come home, yeah. But we definitely think that those projectiles were rocks. We tested different objects. I mean, we tested everything, and it was the closest thing looked like a rock that maybe had been slightly heated, like it'd been held for a while in a big hand, right?
Sure.
Because the heat's going to it's gonna insulate it. So anyways, that night, eventually we had nothing happen for like 20 minutes. You know, I'm filming about a half hour, nothing happening. We're freezing our butts off. I'm running low on the last of the batteries. I've been up 48 out of 50 hours. The adrenaline's wearing off now too. And I made the call. I made the rest of everybody, we're going to go to bed. Pretend we're going to bed. And I, you know, got back in my car and I'm filming uphill. And I really thought like I was going to catch like three bipeds descending down that embankment, like trying to exit. Well, we didn't know later until we did the recreations. One of them did exit right behind Todd and Roe and headed north out of that meadow and just walked on the grass quietly between the back of my vehicle. And Todd had plenty of space. I mean, we're talking 50 yards, 70 yards. And behind where my vehicle was, and this is what's interesting is most of the activity that precipitated me going up, it was in the southwest side of camp. Well, I had reconnaissance cameras on the wheel wells of two vehicles covering the whole southwest side of camp. We didn't know until we did the investigation, but guess what side of camp they coincidentally avoided?
The side with the cameras.
The whole southwest side of camp.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, it could be coincidence, but I ran with it, and now that makes a difference what I do from reconics, you know, using game cams. I use them more as a choke, like trying to push them, you know.
That's
where,
a great point.
You know, where
so,
I want them.
You know, that's a really great point, and I'm glad you said that because, you know, you can use things to your advantage. So we know we've not got Sasquatch on a game camera, and for whatever reason, we think that they know that they're there, and they look odd, and they don't want to be anywhere around them. They obviously don't know what they are, but yeah, that's a great idea. So you basically flanked those in a way that it would force something to walk through that funnel. Yeah, that's a really great idea.
Correct.
All right. I just stole that from you.
And you made a great point because, I mean, we don't know what the deterrence is. Is it the strategic placement, the smell of the plastic, the internal noise, the animals here that we don't? Some give a shit, some don't, right?
Right.
Is it the IR beam? What is it? What combination of factors would be the deterrent? Whatever it is, I think they just know it's something artificial. They don't like it, and I think they just are able to stay clear from it.
You know, I don't think we're ever going to know until we've got one to observe. I think that's just until you biologically know what the eyes can see. You know, what frequencies they can see, I guess, you know, and, you know, there's different levels. And I've talked to my friend Carl on other shows about this, but that's just something that we're just going to have to wait to see. You know,
I agree.
That's my two cents.
I think you're right.
So,
no, I think you're absolutely right.
Any footprints, brother? Did you guys get any impressions around that area?
Oh, you could see where things were disturbed. I mean, where things were, because we had to do, so what ended up happening is, as I said, I really believed Dan, I was going to catch them coming downhill, but that we didn't know already. They had already exited. And it's funny because I wake up a couple hours later, right? Sun's out. And I woke up with my head hanging outside my car with the thermal draped on my neck, hanging off my, I mean, I just left my heart on the field. There was nothing left, you know? And then I had to drive the hardest part. Imagine now you got footage, but you can't review it until you drive 6.5 hours home. I didn't even have my laptop.
Oh, man.
It was being repaired. I mean, this was, I remember me and Justin talking about it in the morning, leaving and driving out. It was just like, to not know what it looked. I mean, it was just like, you know, I remember it. I had an idea of what I, you know, exactly everything I filmed, but you know, you wish you could review it immediately. So it was interesting. I felt so naked leaving there because I'm a check the box due diligence guy, and to have footage without any of it done, any investigation, anything done. So this is what happened. A lot of people don't know this. It's Bumpy Lake. Had my 07 sighting. We were leaving 2 weeks later, Robert and myself, Leiterman, Ranger Leiterman. He's the one I put ahead of the investigation and been a field partner for, God, the whole 20 years that I've really been in. And we did this road trip. We go through Oregon, go to Washington. And we were looking forward to it all year. Well, I had to cancel that because now we have to go do recreations. We have to get the team together, right. redirect yep. everybody, yep. and go to the Sierra. As a matter of fact, I had to pay, when I had a friend from Nebraska coming, him and his son, had to pay like $1,500 to divert their flight because they had already set up to Washington. But I, you know, at that point, it just, you know, I had a mission and I didn't care. And I had a responsibility to them. So anyways, that was all taking place. Kip Morrell was one of my best friends, you know, Kip.
Yep.
That was the first trip we were together, and he, thank God I had him. He was really my model because, you know, Kip is 6'3", right?
He's huge.
He's taller guy. Huge. And he was the perfect for the recreation. So we went back, and it was over the course of, it was 10 days. We spent about 80, I mean, literally probably about 60, 65 hours on the video, the recreations, the interviews. I had half of the guys with me were law enforcement, Leiterman. I put him in charge of the investigation because it behooves him to really get to the truth because we're so attached at the hip with each other, right? And I needed to be the most objective. And then I had polling due once we got everything we did on site. And, you know, we realized we had all these realizations like, oh, my God. I mean, they were 35 yards away from
all right. Well, yeah, so this is great for the listeners, right? So list through some of these observations that you went, holy crap, holy crap, holy crap, as you're going through this recreation.
Well, I never would have thought, that they would have creeped that close in with 35 yards. But if you're there, you understand, you know, like I said, it was 58% waxing moon. We had decent tree cover and they had a small fire. So where the squatches were standing actually would have been the actual, the darkest point of camp. There was, as long as they're not making noise or they're not trying to, initiate anything, you'd never know they were there. I mean, it was like a pitch black wall almost. I'm surprised Todd even saw things in the silhouettes, but you could, you know, looking up the hill. And so that was just shocking because remember when I went back down to camp with Sean?
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, I'm telling the guys, be cool. You know, everyone just, but in the meantime, I'm kind of inconspicuously, I'm trying to spot them from the bottom. So I'm looking up and I'm looking up in all the tree gaps. And I can tell you right now, I already know, I bypassed the gap they were in mm-hmm. because I never would have believed, and not being familiar with the area, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I never would have believed they would have been that close. I was looking higher up. And so we, we didn't know any of this until doing it. Like I told you, that one exited stage left actually went north. And it's weird. It looks like a biped person behind the guys. I mean, you can't, you know, you just see them walking, this biped walking north right through the meadow. And
you got to wonder why did they scatter in different directions? Or maybe they didn't. You just saw the one, but
maybe they didn't. Maybe we just saw the one. Yeah. It's kind of hard to
I don't want
to
make that
kind of hard
then.
To say.
So I have this, I'm always interested in why the rock throwing, and clearly when that missile comes, I've seen the video and it bounces off the tree. I mean, that's with purpose, right? I guess my question is, I always have this theory that these things will throw rocks to get you to do human stuff again. So it's almost like when activity dies down, they throw something so they can get a reaction. I could be totally wrong, but it's almost like, you know, when you're a kid, you mess with the bugs, and when they're doing bug stuff, you just kind of poke them a little to get a reaction. I always wonder.
Makes a lot of sense.
You know, I don't know. I'm just spitballing, but it's just kind of one of those things. And I've noticed that I've only had two experiences one is there was a tree knocked over this last summer, and you were there while you were in the area. And then there was another time we got a knock when I was with Shane and Chris Spencer, and it was when things were kind of like dying down, kind of. It was almost like the tree pushover, that was definitely aggressive, for sure, no doubt. But this other one, and I just got to wonder, I don't know. I mean, does it sound like something that might have merit?
Well, I will tell you this, maybe, because I've also had a couple times, you know, I've had a lot of activity with Bo, not visuals, but with Bobo. We've spent a lot of time together out there, and we've got paralleled out one time, and off a coastal trail. That's was able to get the tree destruction video. That was the next time going out. But it was funny because we were aggressively followed out, and also had, you know, everything had died down. It was over. There was nothing going on. Nothing had happened for the last 10, 15 minutes. And just when you're just kind of, you know, getting near the trailhead, boom. And I mean, jumped out of your shoes. Just
tell me about that experience. The listeners don't know what that, walk us through that. Absolutely.
Yeah, there's actually a couple really beautiful coastal trails up in Northern California on the coast. And we would hug the coast like this time of year. Like I'll probably be up there in the next couple weeks, month or whatever. But that NorCal coast, bears don't even go into dormancy there. If they do, they go a month because there's food year round. You have redwood spruce cover, so you've got wind rain protection.
Yeah.
It almost kind of is a better situation because it narrows the playing field. You know they're not going to be at the higher elevations, and all the food is going to be against the coast. So you actually have a shorter field, if you will, during that time. But here's the issue. It's also like an oxygen chamber, very green. And so a lot of rain and a lot of thick undergrowth, ferns, whatever. So it's very difficult to get footage, thermal footage in that kind of atmosphere, but it's a great sound zone. You know what I mean? Like the sound is, if you have it going on, you can get it, capture everything, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I'd gone up there with Bobo. We do our annual brother trip around Christmas time. And we had gone up, this was 2010, December. And we laid a tarp out. We hiked in like 3-4 miles. It's like 1:30 in the morning. We just put a tarp out, did a couple of calls. And then just, you know, BSing for an hour and just forget where we were, you know, we were just there and I just driven up 9 hours. So anyways, we started hearing loud power knocks, right? Coming mm-hmm. from north of us. And we just look at each other all, oh yeah. So the way we do it is we know from, you know, you stand your ground at some points, but this is one where it was a perfect scenario. Try to get parallel, try to get followed, and then I've got the thermal and I might be able to catch them in the clear that way, because uphill is an incline just loaded with undergrowth, so it's thick there, and on the bottom is like a swampy bottom land.
So okay, like let me just back up there, and I'm sorry to interrupt you, but when you say try to get followed, if I'm listening to this, I'm going to say, well, yeah, but what do you mean by try to get followed? Do you use the terrain to your advantage? Do you, like, what does that mean?
I was trying to gain an advantage because we were at a major disadvantage. It was wonderful to be in a dark, enclosed place on a trail, hear those knocks, and it's pitch black, and it's wonderful, but I've got no view to try to get footage, and that's my objective. I don't care as much, you know, about the sound. We want to get it, absolutely, but this, you know, I have an objective. And so what we do is we kind of moseyed on, just kind of played like we're a little bit, you know, just initially kind of scared, you know, that we're just kind of walking back the trail, like we got creeped out over it. We're just going to walk back. And it's funny, he's on the recording. I'm telling him, and I go, God, if they come, you know, because the incline, you know, it's the perfect vantage point to parallel you, and we probably wouldn't even hear it. Well, sure enough, after about 75 yards of getting away from where we're sitting down, heading back, you hear what sounds like a plastic pop at the same time. Bobo's all, Bart, it's there. It's right there. And he's pointing uphill. And it was so bold because it was only like 30 feet away from us on the incline. Just imagine you're walking on a trail,
mm-hmm.
tight trail, and then it inclines above you and it has all the undergrowth, right? So anything could be up there.
And all the advantage.
But this thing, exactly, all the advantage. It was so bold that it was like, wow. And Bo will never admit it, but we were bumping shoulders walking out of there that night. And I don't even think we had a red light or whatever, but it kind of died down and just dissipated and it kind of ended there. But I got all the audio from it. And what was interesting is we got the single knocks. I'll get back to what had happened with the power knock later. Mm-hmm. I go back 60 days later, same spot, Ranger Letterman. And now but we're much earlier. It was like either, I think it was just past, it just got dark. Same exact spot. We're going to probably stay there for the night. I start in with the Knox calls. Bam! Power knock. Now, this is interesting. If you listen to the recordings on the single Knox, 60 days apart, they're acoustically identical. Whatever is making that sound and however it's being made, it's acoustically identical.
So do you think same tool, same tree? Is that what you're saying? Like same
tool. I'm not convinced it's a tree. I mean, I think it could be rock on rock.
Gotcha.
I think it could be clapping. I mean, there could be multiple ways, because the response is so, at least the ones that I've heard, you know, and have recorded, very consistent, almost like a slight whip to the knock, like a power wood knock sound, but there's a slight, like a whip to it, kind of.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so Robert's filming me in night vision, and it's kind of cool because you get the context of the exchange live, and that's the NorCal tree destruction video we recorded. And about 9 minutes later, this thing gets pissed off on the hill above me and tears a tree down. It sounds like 9 gunshots going off. It was awesome in person. I mean, just powerful. And then after we stood our ground, which was kind of a mistake in hindsight, you know, we were willing to just, you know, stay there, roll it out. We were giddy, and nothing else happened, not only the rest of the night, but the rest of the trip going, but, you know, obviously you're going to try again, same spot, same, you know, next night. Mm-hmm. Nothing else happened at that point. But going back, you listen to the recording, and it's actually, even though the tree destruction's awesome, and they covered that on Finding Bigfoot, it's the single acoustic knocks that really, really intrigued me, you know, in that regard. And then what happened was, this area is gorgeous. The national parks, it's beautiful during the day. There's nobody there at night. And I'd actually stayed in this place maybe 50 times and never had activity before Bobo and I got followed out. Then the next time I go, Leiterman and myself, we get the tree destruction. Nothing else happens in the same spot going back for 5 years for me. Actually, what am I saying? 5 years? It's actually longer. It was about 7 years. And then the day after Thanksgiving in 18, Bobo and I got surrounded and got the same knocks again. And that was the power knock I was telling you about coming off that trail. We thought it was all over. We're walking out. Boom. And we both jumped out of our shoes because we just thought it was done, you know.
Right.
We just weren't expecting it.
Yeah, everybody says, when you get a big experience like that, I've heard Bobo say it, you know, a tree crash or a call or some aggressive behavior, you may as well go home because it's done for the night.
Exactly. Exactly. And when it dies down, I mean, that's it. I mean, it's over. I've never had activity like the same, like the same place 2 nights in a row, for instance, never. I've heard other people that have.
Yeah. You know? So let me ask you this question. I'm a big believer in intuition and that you just know what you know and something's up. Have you ever been in a position, you know, you and Bobo or whoever going out and researching, and you get there and you just know it's going down, like something's going to happen. Is there something that triggers you? Or does that not happen to you at all?
That you mean like you kind of feel it and sense it?
Yeah, like in your bones, like you sense it, you know, and I almost feel like it's animalistic. Like when we get in there, we go back to some sort of instinct that maybe is awoken or we didn't have, you know, and it's like you just know when it's going to happen. I felt that one time when an experience happened, but I'm just curious, as you ever get that feeling, you put any credibility into that? Or,
you know, no one's ever asked me that. And I think it's a great question. And my answer is going to surprise you. As I've gotten older, you know, and through the years, I've realized I'm actually probably more intuitive than most. I know a lot of people say that about themselves or whatever, but
right.
I mean, enough to those around me, no, put it that way. Mm-hmm. All the major incidences that I've had out there, totally unexpected. I didn't see it coming. Matter of fact, I would have told you a million other instances where I thought we would have activity or have a better chance or have a better, you know what I mean? It would never in my wild. I wish I could tell you a great story about how we hiked out, you know, 50 miles. We stayed out there all month and, you know, and give you this big sexy story, but no, the best stuff that's happened to me, that those are a couple miles from a small, I don't know if I call it a town, but you know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, that leads to
another one where there's a big camping area.
Yeah. But okay. So the reason I asked that question is my question was, okay, if those things had happened to you that it would intuitively happen and then something happened, my next question is, okay, what's the environment? What were you doing? What time of night was it? Because do those things correlate? But it sounds to me like maybe there's nothing there from a research or logic standpoint that you can point to, because it's just kind of, like you said, unexpected. I was just trying to get to that, but it sounds like there's nowhere to really go based on what you just told me.
Yeah, it's weird. It's just, yeah, I just the best ones. But then when it has, like, you know, you've experienced this, you've had it happen, you just kind of, it doesn't affect you as much. Like the last time where me and Bobo, we were surrounded by the Knox. It was like, we might as well be having drinks on Miami Beach, you know, or yeah. You know, it just was, you just get comfortable in that vibe. You know that, you know, it may get dicey, but you kind of know nothing's going to happen and you got each other, worst case. And if it does, well, you know, it's bad luck, I guess.
Yeah,
you
know? No, yeah. And the other question that I had is, and I always feel like a sense of responsibility because I'll get email from folks that say, hey, I listen to your show, I listen to other shows, and now I go out into the woods and I research and yada, yada. But I always preach to these people safety, right? In numbers, you know what you're doing. How do you prepare? I know you don't half-ass it. Like when you go out there, you prepare for certain eventualities. But talk about if somebody was going to go out there, like do it safely, and here's what I would recommend.
I'd probably not tell them to come out with me, at least initially. And I only say that not because I'm not taking precautions and I'm not preparing for those eventualities, which is absolutely true. I mean, like I'm prepared, I could be stuck out there for a while. I mean, I'm okay, but it's just, it's more or less the learning to walk at night. You know, there's a way it's you know, for instance, pitch black. You learn to read through the treetops. That's how that's how you know you're spacing and you're walking, and you learn to feel and you learn to walk without making much noise. But because I try not to ever use the benefit of a light source, not because I think I'm some, you know, smart guy and I'm going to fool them. No, it's not that at all. I just want to give them the window and I want to be different. And because I think it pisses them off of the fact of why are you walking around? You know, they're used to us needing the benefit of a light source to negotiate the forest at night. That's probably, that's almost all of us. We're the only idiots out there running around like that, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think that makes, that's an attraction. That's a curiosity. I think that's paid dividends, possibly, you know. I do believe that that's a correlation. So as far as prep going out, like I'm prepared to survive that night, you know, with everything I have, but beyond that, you know, I just wouldn't come out with me at first until you get used to maneuvering in the dark. And once you get that down, which won't take, it doesn't take a long time, but you got to practice at it.
Yep. Then you absolutely.
You just learn to really, the only thing that impedes you actually is actually my thermal, because it messes up your night vision temporarily.
Oh yeah.
That's the thing that will impede me periodically. And that's why I like going out with a partner sometimes too. Just so I have someone to gauge, because sometimes you don't have that clarity in the thermal, depending on what the atmospheric temperatures are. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And you can kind of see, oh, there's the wedge right there. There's the sea. You know, you just get a better baseline gauge, you know, when you're out there, because your night vision kind of gets screwed up. So I also like to have somebody with me that is exactly like me in that regard, used to it or whatever. So, you know, you can kind of depend on each other off that.
Biggest mistake you've ever made in a research mode somewhere, anything you look back on and go, man, I really shit the bed on that?
I think at times kind of possibly overdoing it. You know, I'm very, very discriminatory with calling and knocking. I hate to say it, but it works. All my best incidences have actually been provoked, and it was either two days later, type of thing. But I think there's probably times like I've overdone it, maybe blown out an area. I think one of the biggest mistakes made in the Sierras, I haven't had a lot happen since I got the Sierras footage up there. We've had shit happen. I mean, I've had rock thrown at us. We've had wood knocks. We've had all kinds of, I mean, actually a couple of my guys, Michael Lorenz, maybe even seen one with thermal through the trees a couple years later when we were up there. But I think the biggest mistake is the catch 22 was you get the footage, then you're trying to document it properly and you're trying to set an example for the field. Right. And then guess what? Well, people start figuring out pretty quick where it is. And the people that are with you are getting asked all the time where it is. And then you're going to take some people up where it is. And then we did the recreate. So it was almost like you had to almost give up the spot.
Right.
To do the proper due diligence and do the investigation. And so it really was a double-edged sword. And if that was something I can do over, it'd be tough, you know, because I maybe would have sat longer on the footage, but maybe just, but we did, we kind of did, now that I'm thinking about it, we kind of did, you know, we released it because it took me a long time and Robert a long time to write all that stuff up. I mean, there's the whole investigation consisted of, like I told you, all those hours, 11 recreation videos, 4 analysis reports. He wrote 2, I wrote 2. And that's going through every detail, trial and error, every candidate possibility, scenarios, measurements. I mean, if it was a book, you know, if I'd put it together in a book, you would have went, wow, this is a great book to thumb through and look, you know, everything was answered, but I also learned something else too. You know, everyone always says, you know, give us the evidence, give us the, you know, do a proper investigation, do the proper well, we did it all. I mean, we did it all. And then I realized that a lot of people, they don't want to go read it. They don't want to do the due diligence for what you provide them.
Correct.
So they want to be told by somebody they trust and get their answers right away. And we see that in politics. We see that in everything, right?
Oh, yeah. Human nature. Path of least resistance.
Relegated to the Bigfoot field. But it was that was a learning experience to me because, you know, Roe wanted, I remember Roe was trying to advise me more to layer out the stuff we were releasing. And I was like, no. I want full transparency. I want it all out now. I want it all. But it was almost overwhelming.
Yeah, that's, you know, the problem. Like, no, yeah, you can overwhelm somebody. You know, it's like you can easily.
And
I mean,
it's not,
go ahead.
Yeah. And it's not the Patterson film either. You know, if it was, then people are going to go through that more of that due diligence. But it was more, okay, this is, you know, CC minus footage, but this is what an A++ investigation with full transparency looks like.
Yep.
And so everybody, you know, anyone else gets footage, boom, model it after this. At least come to this standard, if not exceed it, you know, especially if you get better footage.
What do you think happens when science actually, when research science actually catches up to what you guys are doing and there's verification that things are real? How does that change? Does it change how you look at researching? Is it going to upend the world? Like, what do you fear? What do you like about that? When it will eventually happen?
I'm really curious to see. Part of me can envision what it will look like, and then other days I can't see it. Even though I've seen them, I know they're real, whatever. There's just this, because so little has happened. The needle's moved so little, you know, over the years, that it just frustrates the hell out of you, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I think what I would love to see would be, I'd love to know the answers to my questions. We all have questions, but I'm saying, I'd love to answer my questions like, how close were a lot of the, you know, the theories I've had, like, over the year? Like, how did that, of how we got to this point, right? And I think a lot of that has to do with human beings as much as it does with Bigfoot, because most people, when that sun goes down, they're inherently congregating, you know, and they're also reactive in using equipment versus being proactive.
Mm-hmm.
It's got to be boring. Most nights it's horrible. I can't even lift my arm anymore. You know what I mean? From having that damn thing, my eyes are killing me. I would love, though, to know stuff like, I've always theorized that what we've done on this continent in the last 300 years, we didn't make things harder for them. I think they adapted to us and we've made it better for them, because the foraging opportunities are all over the place. 300 years ago, the competition for food was a whole different story on this continent. And look what we've done with, like, we create artificial metal. Every time we clear cut, it doesn't matter what you think from an environmental standpoint, that's indicating to some of these apex predators that there's going to be an In-N-Out burger restaurant coming here within about 10 months or so, because they know the deer are going to come feed on the hard edges. You know what I mean?
Right,
so
right. Like, yeah. It's almost like the sharks know when there's certain activity in the ocean, go toward it because there's going to be food.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Look what we've done with water. Yep. I mean, look what we, for all the, you know, damming habitat, more riparian area. Like, I think they can be in places they could never be in the winter 300 years ago, and now they could be in those states because there isn't a foraging opportunity there.
You know what, brother? There seems to be, though, there's a side of me that, you know, getting back to the question of discovery, is there's a side to me that doesn't want that to happen. I don't want the mystery taken away. I don't want the fact that I'm doing something.
I hate that part of it too.
But yeah, I mean, because it just seems so like, okay, it's over, now what? But there's nothing. I mean, I'm just like, I'm hooked. You know what I mean? What am I going to do at that point? But yeah, I mean, science has got to catch up at some point, you know?
I agree with you. And that does bother me too, but it's been, You know, it's interesting because we all have our objectives. There's a lot of people in the Bigfoot world too that they're just, they like some of the notoriety that goes with it. They like some of the attention that goes with it, or they want to sell some stuff or whatever it is. For me, it's always been about the chase and discovery, proving the damn things are real. If they were real, you know, proving that they're real, or a colleague, somebody else proving that. I don't care who it is. You know what I mean? I want it done. I want it done while my parents are alive to see it. That's my own selfish.
It's a passion for sure.
You know, but I do know what you mean, because, I mean, let's be honest, you take the mystery out of it and what the hell are we going to do after that?
Right. Exactly.
I don't know.
I'm not going to UFOs, man. That's not my thing. You know, I'm into Bigfoot.
Yeah,
we'll keep it there.
Fascinating.
I mean, God bless everyone who does it, but for some reason it just doesn't hook me into it. But yeah, man, I think
you just brought up a good point.
Yeah, what's that?
You just brought up a good point, because if, you know, there's a lot of people that say, "Oh, what if they're paranormal or whatever that's supposed to mean, or have these quote unquote capabilities, whatever." And I've always been open minded to that, but never so open minded my brains are going to fall out, right? But I think it all has to be geared towards science. If there's other capabilities, and well, then when we get to that point, we get to that point. In the meantime, it's all speculation. It's basically bullshit. So,
okay, so let me ask this question. You just made half of everyone who's listening just do a huge eye roll whenever you say, like, paranormal and Bigfoot. You know, I've talked to David Ellis in the past about this, and this is nothing he won't
love him,
like, want me to not say, but he just says, keep your mind open. Don't discredit anything. In my mind, the odds of this being some sort of paranormal thing are, like, astronomically, like, low, like it wouldn't happen. You, for some reason, for you to say that, what even leaves the door open a little bit for you? Was it experiences, things you've heard? Because what you just said makes me think there's just a little sliver of maybe in your thought process.
I think part of it that you have so many people that run to that way too prematurely. I feel like they can't justify existence, and that opens the door. And especially if they think they've seen one, you know, then how are these things real? You know, they start making that jump, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the best way to answer this, I look at it as this. Put it this way: been in the field 18 years. I've been a lot of places. I've seen a lot of things. I've done a lot of things. If I hadn't seen them with my own eyes by now, I would really, I wouldn't say I'd be 100% on the other side, but I'd be close, because I'm skeptic by nature. I just don't, it's got to be proven, you know, for me to believe it. I've actually had a hard time sometimes with this, because it's like, it's a weird position to be in, to know, to have seen them so clear that you know it can't be anything else, and you know they're real, and then not see the progress on the other end. You have justifications for it, because, you know, the ecology and other things. You can make, you know, I can make arguments all day long, but I think it's been just pure luck to this point, if nothing else.
Do you ever in a quiet moment, like when you're thinking to yourself, go, is this real? Did I see what I saw? Do you ever second guess yourself? And you've been doing this for so long, and the answer might be no, Bart, but I'm just curious, because from a guy who's not had that experience, it's like at sometimes I just go, geez, you know, I haven't seen one. I've been around things that are really interesting, but
right. Is
this real? Or am I just chasing my tail? Do you ever have those moments where you just question yourself?
I do, but it's so temporary, because it's one of those things that it's so, like, once you've seen them,
that's a thing. Yeah.
You can't unsee it. I mean, I can sit there and say, like, I'd be lying if I were to go, Dave, you know, well, let's see. Okay. The first one, you know, that maybe there's some partial obstruction. No, I'd be lying to you. I'd be lying to you to try to frame a story around, to try to make it more ambiguous than it was. I mean, there was just, so I'm very grateful on that end to know for sure. But it does still blow me away. Like, I just feel like even by accident, we should be a lot further along than we are. And it's remarkable to me, as day in, day out. And how many people, too, that have been witnesses. Like, it turned out that I really knew a lot of people even personally before I got in the Bigfoot field, and even from after. of how many people were witnesses. And the one thing that really, it wasn't the Patterson film that drove me in. It was, like I was saying, it was always the, a lot of the circumstantial reports and the consistencies. But what always said a lot to me is most of my peers in the field, right? And from all different ages and all different, all different
walks of life. And yeah, absolutely.
Walks of life. And I mean, everybody, but it always said a lot to me when you had a situation where maybe, say, for instance, one spouse had the come to Jesus moment citing it, no prior, not like me, who had the prior interest and then eventually got the invisible chains off and got involved and then, you know, was able to see. I'm talking about someone who can care less, had the come to Jesus moment, and then they're 100% involved in the pursuit to the point that the other spouse doesn't even understand. That's half the people I know in this field that I get out with.
Yeah.
And that always said a lot to me.
Yeah. There's, and I think I, as I'm sorting through the question that I just asked, and it could come across as, well, hey, you know, do you second guess what you saw? I guess what I'm trying to get at is the energy level. You know, do you ever get to a point where you go, dude, I'm just exhausted? You know, like I've been doing this for 18 years. I know these things are there. I've seen them twice. I've had XYZ experience, but man, I'm just tired.
Yeah, I think I feel that way sometimes. Yeah, definitely. But it's also too, I think it's age, it's kids, it's life, you know, it's a busy career. It's, you know what I mean? It's those things too. And then you just kind of narrow it down where like maybe a lot of the things that meant a lot to you before, I don't want to say they don't mean anything to me anymore, but it's like I have a clear objective, love the people that I, you know, I get out with and pursue with. From all, you know, like I said, all walks of life, mm-hmm. different states, different. I have, you know, gang here, gang there. It's great. I absolutely love it. But it's like, it's more fine-tuned into, I wouldn't call myself a weekend warrior, but in a way I am. I'm not an endurance guy. I'm not a guy that's going to be out there for a month.
There's nothing wrong with that. You know, a day or two here at a time is perfect.
You're going to get 5, 6, 7, 8 nights of, you know, 100%, I'm barely sleeping, the thing never leaves my eye, but then it's like I hit a wall, done. I just, at that point, like, I've got to start recovering. Like, I just can't, you know, and that's fine. It's worked out. I mean, that's worked out fine. You know, it's just get right to it. I mean, just, I know what I want to do. I know what I'm looking for. And I'm not saying I know what they are, but I'm saying I know what I'm looking for, you know, when I go out there.
Do you, sorry, brother, go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
No, I was gonna ask. I'm a sidearm carry guy. What are your thoughts on that out in the field? Because, and I have a reason for asking this. This isn't like a trap question, but I have a reason for asking this. So I'm kind of curious as to your thoughts.
Good question. I've only carried a piece with me actually a few times. If you believe it or not, bought my first gun for the last year. I'm 47 years old. I was just never a gun guy, and everybody I know in the field, they've got like 12 to 72 guns, right? So I eventually pulled the trigger. But I'll carry bear spray on me. Sometimes I've got a weapon on me. Depends on where I'm at. I'm not worried about black bears. I'm not really worried about cougars. I'm more worried about people, to be honest with you.
Right.
When I'm out there. But, and you know what? I would say 3/4 of the people I get out with, they've already got a sidearm on them. So it's not, you know what I mean? One less thing for me to carry, but sometimes I do, depending on where I'm at. You know, that's a big deal, because we've been to some rough areas. You go to like Northern California, the Hoopa Reservation, mm-hmm. areas like that. There's, you know, you'll turn a bend and you'll see a burning car in broad daylight just sitting there in the middle of a forest road. You know, some of these places we go.
You're walking into the Thunderdome.
Yeah. Exactly. Exactly.
And the reason I asked that question, Bart, is that I feel like there's a different mindset when I'm in the woods without a gun than I am with a gun. I feel like, and this goes, it's counterintuitive to the safety thing, but I feel more like I'm more aware when I don't have a gun, because I have to be more aware, if that makes sense.
Makes a lot of sense. Absolutely.
So I'm kind of changing. Yeah, go ahead.
You're used to having... But you've had weapons for years, right? I mean, you've been
mm-hmm.
okay. See, and I think there's always, See, I never had a full baseline for that, because I would only have weapons sporadically, and so. But I get exactly what you're saying. It's very interesting because there's a lot of psychology behind that and what you're, you know, what you're out there, what's your intent, what kind of energy are you giving off? Well, I know where you're going with that.
Yeah. It's just kind of weird. So, you know, we'll see what happens, but, I don't know, man, when I'm up in the Pacific Northwest, not having a gun kind of freaks me out because you guys have big cats. They're huge.
did you happen to see the, talk about big cats? This is pretty mind blowing. Did you see the three that passed by my front door we caught on the ring?
No, I'll have to go to your page.
Beautiful. My wife posted it. Beautiful mother and two adult-sized kittens. I mean, like, nice. Nobody's business walking right past my front door here in Carmel Valley, right in the mouth of the valley.
Yep.
The cats are everywhere right now around town. I mean, people are getting, you know, footage of them. They just shot one. I've never seen so many mountain lions in my life.
What are they saying? What are they attributing that to? What was Fish and Game saying?
You know, it's interesting. I think some of it is some of the previous fires had pushed them out. We did have a lot of fires here that just kind of uprooted, I think, a lot of habitat. They look pretty healthy, so they don't look like they're, you know, it's so much a foraging problem. But I think too, a lot less human activity, you know, with COVID we've had. I mean, you wouldn't believe the stuff that I see walking out. I mean, I'm in a semi-forested area, but I mean, just, 100 turkeys. That, you know.
Oh, yeah, we have coyotes now. Yep.
I mean, everything is ever bobcats in my backyard. The only thing I haven't seen a black bear here yet, which they're sporadic. There's not that many here in the Central Coast. But, and Squatch, I mean, I see everything else goes in and out of my yard. It's unbelievable.
You know, it's really strange. Well, not strange. I mean, you make a good point because there's certainly not a ton of people out right now. And I live just outside of Boston, not that far.
Yeah.
Man, we see coyotes now all the time where we never did before. And they're like on the streets in Cambridge and stuff. And just like, wait, what is going on here? I thought 2020 was over.
What time of year do you usually see them there? Over there in Massachusetts.
We see them we see them year round. But we've just been seeing more of them.
I figured winter would be a deterrent. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, the deterrent would be the number of people that are out. I mean, parks are empty. The trails that you walk along in the wooded areas are pretty empty. And so these things are, you know, feel free to just roam around. I mean, then they're really starting to cut through neighborhoods. Like you said, we're seeing a ton of turkeys that we never did before. Yeah, it's just strange. But, yeah. So again, man, thanks for the hang, so to speak. Thanks for spending time with us. Certainly a privilege. I know you got a ton of things going on and, you know, imparting that wisdom and some of these experiences has been great, but, love to have you back sometime, man. If the stars align.
Absolutely. No, absolutely. And you know, I consider I've been very fortunate. I mean, yeah, I've put the time in and I've had the right people and maybe learned some of the right lessons, but don't get me wrong. There was a lot of trial and error, you know, to get to that point, you know, a lot of failure. And, it's just, you know, you have a passion for something and you do something you have a passion for, you're never a prisoner of time, you know, and it's something that when I'm out there, yeah, it's like a different mode. It's a different level. It's almost inherently, it's somehow what I was meant to do, you know, in some ways, you know, at least as a passionate hobby.
In the year 2525, if man is still alive, if woman can survive, they may find. In the year 3535, ain't gonna need to tell the truth, tell no lies. Everything you think, do, and say is in the pill you took today. In the year 4545, ain't gonna need your teeth, won't need your eyes. You won't find a thing to chew, nobody's gonna look at you. In the year 5555, your arms are hanging limp at your side. Your legs got nothing to do, some machine doing that for you. In the year 65, 65, ain't gonna need no husband, won't need no wife. You pick your son, pick your daughter too, from the bottom of a long glass tube, whoa, whoa. In the year 7510, if God's a-coming, he ought to make it by then. Maybe he'll look around himself and say, guess it's time for the judgment day. In the year 8510, God is gonna shake his mighty head. He'll either say, I'm pleased where man has been, or tear it down and start again. Whoa, whoa. In the year 95, 95, I'm kinda wondering if man is gonna be alive. He's taken everything this old earth can give, and he ain't put back nothing. Whoa, whoa. Now it's been 10,000 years. Man has cried a billion tears for what he never knew. Now man's reign is through, but through eternal night, the twinkling of starlight, so very far away, maybe it's only yesterday. In the year 2525, if man is still alive, if woman